Hi, everyone, and welcome to this episode of The Ravencast. I am your host, Adam Erickson, and I'm here with our special guest today, Vanessa Avery. Hi, Vanessa.
Hi, Adam.
How are you
today?
Hi,
everyone else. I'm great. Thank you.
Good. Awesome. I love the guitars in your background.
Thank you.
Do you play guitar?
I do a little bit.
We should have you open up the show with a little song. That'd be awesome.
Oh, gosh. Well, these are my kidding. Husband's. My husband would do a much better job of that.
Awesome.
Hi, Jed. Well, I know he's listening.
Yeah, I see Jed is on. And next time we interview Vanessa, we'll have Jed come on and do a little intro to the show.
That sounds good.
Awesome. Well, Vanessa, I'm excited to have you on today. We're going to talk about Judaism and atonement and mimetic theory and the nonviolence of God, which is all stuff that I get jazzed about. So excited to have you on the show today. But I want to let everybody know that the Raven Cast is a product of the Raven Review, an online magazine where we write and talk about mimetic theory and the rivalry and violence and scapegoating that so often divides our country, our communities, and our world. Our motto at the Raven Review is change your view, change the world. So if you like to hear new perspectives on religion, politics, pop culture, and current events, perspectives that bridge divides and hopes to bring people together, then please go on over to the Raven Review and subscribe at ravenfoundation.org. Just a little note on scheduling. Next Thursday at 12 o'clock Central, we'll have another live Ravencast with Sue Wright, the President of Theology and Peace. We're going to talk about the upcoming Theology and Peace conference, which is titled Embracing We-Centricity, Practices That Nurture the Common Good. So I hope you can join us then. But today I'm so excited because we have Vanessa Avery on the show. Vanessa is a diversity and organizational consultant. She earned her PhD in religious studies. She holds degrees from just a few universities, University of Exeter, Yale Divinity School, King's College London, and McGill University. You've done a lot of education.
Yeah. I was kind of a collector of degrees for a while. I hope I'm past that, actually.
Yeah. That's awesome. Yeah, my wife says that she doesn't want me to be a full-time student for the rest of my life. So what are you going to do? Vanessa is the author of many articles, including the article that we're going to talk about today, which is from the book Mimesis and Atonement. And that article is called Atonement and the Book of Jonah. She's also the author of the article, The Jewish Vaccines Against Mimetic Desire, Watchmen and Mimetic Theory, Wither, Girard, and Islam, and Engaging Difference, Exercises and Tips for Creating Experiential Learning Environments. And there's a great article about Vanessa and her organizational consulting titled, Why is Scapegoating So Common at Work? And you can find that just by Googling the title. But Vanessa, why is scapegoating so common at work?
Well, I think it's fundamental to our human nature, unfortunately. And in studying Girard and then studying the scriptures that I interpret through Girard's lens, I got interested in applying that to the diversity work that I've always done in organizations and understanding diversity with the idea of scapegoating connected to it actually opens it up to another level, because we do have people that get scapegoated that are not actually protected by law. The white Christian male, for example. There's really no recourse legally when that happens in the workplace. So we've got the existence of these sacrificial organizations, and we have targets who actually are suffering a great deal, and it can happen to anybody.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I first met Vanessa almost 10 years ago, I think, at a Colloquium on Violence and Religion conference, and Raven invited young mimetic theorists to write on mimetic theory and popular culture. And I led a panel discussion on those papers. And Vanessa, yours was one of the ones we chose. It was the Watchmen paper, Mimetic Theory and Watchmen. And it was so, it inspired me to first watch the movie, and Mimetic Theory just runs throughout that movie. But also I was a youth pastor at the time. And so I showed clips of the movie to my youth group, and it just totally opened up this fantastic conversation on Mimetic Theory. And so I'd advise people to go, they can download your article online, just Google Watchmen and Mimetic Theory and you'll find it. And go watch the movie. It's just fantastic how you put it all together. So thank you for your organizational consultant work, your Hebrew scripture work, and your work on Watchmen. It's just fantastic.
Thank you.
I love it. So tell us how
that's one of my favorite articles, actually, the one I wrote on Watchmen. So I would ask people to read it. It really, I usually don't promote my own work, but I really love that one. It was like just a moment of creative inspiration.
It is fantastic. So yeah, how were you introduced to mimetic theory? Let's get right to the beginning on this.
Sure. Well, it was back at the beginning of my doctorate. I was in the midst of my coursework, and I was studying with the University of Exeter, but up at Hartford Seminary in Hartford, Connecticut, where they had a joint program for the PhD. And my advisor was Dr. Ian Markham, who was at that point the dean of the seminary. And so I was meeting with him about a general discussion about my dissertation. I had to submit a proposal, and I was looking for what exactly to write on. And Dr. Markham gave me some really great advice that I've given to a lot of my students since, which was, if you want to complete your dissertation, write on either a person or an event, because it's actually manageable, as opposed to a theme, which can easily get out of hand. So I said, okay, let's choose a person. I had a few ideas. And then we took a few minutes of silence to just brainstorm with ourselves and think about what people we might come up with. And at the end of the silence, he looked at me and he said, so who did you come up with? And I said, Paul Ricoeur. And I had studied Ricoeur a little bit in my last master's degree. And he focused on a lot of the things I was interested in, like the symbolism of evil and human nature and ontology. And I looked at Dr. Markham. I said, who did you think of? And he said, René Girard. And I said, who's that? So he took a book off his shelf. It was the Girard Reader. And he gave it to me and he said, take it home, have a read. Oh, wow. I took it home, I read it, and I was absolutely fascinated. It really, again, covered all the questions that I was interested in, but in an even more compelling way than Ricoeur had done. And so I chose to write on Girard. And it was at that point I became a member of COVR, the Colloquium on Violence and Religion, and I started meeting other people interested in Girard. And that was really the beginning. It hasn't ended. Not yet.
That's a fantastic story. I love it. I just want to let, we have some people in the audience, and if you have comments or questions for Vanessa, feel free to type them in the chat room that's over there on the left-hand side, and we'll get your comments and questions in, as long as they're nice, right?
Yes. Yes, please be kind. Right. Nonviolent.
That's good. So, Vanessa, you have been an organizational and diversity consultant for quite some time now. You specifically advise companies and religious groups about scapegoating. I would imagine how not to scapegoat or how to avoid scapegoating.
That's the idea.
How did you get into consulting? It's kind of an odd combination of PhD in religious studies and organizational consulting. It's fascinating. So how did you get into it?
That's true. Yes, scapegoating is one area I consult on. Most of my consulting has been on organizational culture and diversity. And I've been consulting since 1999. 1999 is the year after I completed my second master's degree in religious studies. And you kindly listed all of the ones that I had. And so I had just graduated from Yale with my second master's. And I had the bachelor's, and I really wanted to find a way to put those degrees to use. I had so much knowledge. I had so much understanding. I loved what I studied. So I really wanted to be able to share. I also, you know, in my degrees, my master's degrees, I was really always a religious minority. I was, I think, the only Jewish person, at least in my department at King's College London. I'm sure there were others, but I didn't know them. And then I went to Yale, and I was one of two Jews at the Divinity School. And so I've often been put in the position of, you know, addressing, well, what's the Jewish point of view on this passage? Or what is the Jewish point of view on this situation? And so I know there was a lot of room, and there still is room, for more understanding on the religious traditions. I had just moved back to New York City, and I said, what can I do with this? I was familiar with the cultural diversity trainings that were really just kind of getting up to speed in our culture in the late 90s. They had been done before that, but it certainly was very different than today. It was really a growth opportunity. And I started just connecting with diversity trainers, mostly through networking, but there were people I just called up and said, hi, would you come and meet with me and tell me about your business? So I met people, and in asking them questions, I eventually got to, well, how do you feel about religious diversity? Do you incorporate that in your trainings? And really, none of them included it. I said, well, that's a topic we don't need to get into. And the answer that really bothered me was that religious diversity always boils down to some other issue. It always boils down to an issue of time, or maybe cleanliness. So if you're a Rastafarian and you have hair and you work in a kitchen, the issue is cleanliness, not the religion, right? So I actually disagreed with that very strongly. I said, well, sometimes it really is a religious issue. And I decided this was an opportunity and an opening that I really needed to step into. So I just started designing seminars on religious diversity, and I called people and I sold my seminars. And this was, mind you, before 9/11 ever happened. So it was still a little bit of a hard sell, and I did have some success, but after 9/11, it really became crucial and necessary, and people were calling, asking for understanding. And that's how my business took off. And that's how I got started in it. And then there's a long history that, you know, my partnerships and such that I've done since.
Yeah. So you give these workshops to businesses and to religious groups, like churches and synagogues?
I've done many lectures at, you know, for religious groups. Yeah. The trainings in diversity that I do have mostly been in the context of healthcare and academia.
Okay.
So long-term clients have been in healthcare and academia. And then there are lectures that I do for various kinds of organizations.
So what does a workshop look like when you do it?
That's an interesting question. I've incorporated a lot of my material over time, and I've used everything that I've learned has worked. But I recently reinvigorated my business. I took a few years off to do my PhD. I was a faculty member out in the Midwest, and I didn't have much time to really do much consulting. But now that I'm done with all that. I'm very excited to get back in there and work with people on these issues. So the diversity training that I'm doing now, I'm focused a lot on our current climate and how do we really approach people in the current climate. We're so polarized. People have tremendous stress. People have tremendous fear. And diversity has not always been done in a respectful way. So there's a lot of really aggressive trainers out there. And the trainers will focus on, you know, concepts such as power and privilege, which isn't tremendously important to understand, but I think it's created some backlash in our society that people are really upset with the kinds of ways diversity is being taught. They're upset with the very ideas of power and privilege, because many people who we would categorize as privileged in society and historically don't feel privileged. Mm. So we're in a different time, and I think we need to approach these things from a very different angle. So the new business that I have, which is actually called Transcendence Education, also teaches diversity amongst other things. But the way that I approach diversity is really through a very untraditional means. So it's academic, but it's fun and experiential. So it's going to engage intelligence in a different way. So for example, if we're looking at gender diversity, I'm not going to go into your workplace and talk about how men are privileged and microaggressions against women look like this. So I'm not going to do that. What I'm going to do is have a conversation with you about the two different paradigms of gender. So there's constructivist and there's essentialist. Essentially, is our gender in our body or is it in our mind between our ears? And we're going to talk about that. And we might have a mock debate about that so that people can learn to embrace the positions. And then we'll have an open discussion about it. It's a way to access gender diversity through really understanding your own gender, how your gender is created, and then, you know, playing with that idea. And it's a lot of fun. So that's how I intend to approach it. And that's just the start. So it's an easy way, it's a comfortable way for people to kind of get introduced to the topics of diversity. And then if we need to take it further, we can take it further, you know, and I can set up a structure with the organization to really train their employees.
That's fantastic. I love it. Let's get into your chapter on mimesis and atonement. And if people look up this book, Mimesis and Atonement, they'll see that it's pretty expensive. But I also want to let people know that Vanessa's chapter is worth the price of the book. It's fantastic. I read this book, and your article is just kind of a joy to read. It's academic, but as you say, also playful in the way that you go about it. So it's refreshing. So thank you for that.
Thank you.
Your focus in that chapter and in your academic work in general is on violence and its antidotes in the Hebrew scriptures. And this is a pretty radical way to look at the Hebrew scriptures, I think. Like, a lot of atheists say that the Bible should just be discarded because of all the violence in it. But you're taking it as an antidote to violence. Can you explain that? Give us some examples of it.
Yeah, sure. So I've written about a few texts so far that I consider to be antidotes to violence. And I think it's really all on how we've learned to interpret the text. I'll start off just by saying, you know, many of our religious texts are ambiguous by nature. They could support multiple different positions. And we really do have to choose at the end of the day what our fundamental value is, and then use the text to help us really live out our fundamental values. So their ambiguity is on purpose, and it forces us to engage with them on a deeper level, right? If it just said, be peaceful, and then here's what you should do, I think that's not going to engage our humanity. We're more complex than that. So we need to be thinking through these things and grappling with it. So one example that I use as an antidote to violence is Genesis 48, which is toward the end of the book of Genesis. And it's a really funny little story about Jacob blessing his two grandchildren, Ephraim and Manasseh. So interestingly, we have the book of Genesis, which is full of sibling rivalry, almost from the get-go. We have Cain and Abel, we have Isaac and Ishmael, we have Jacob and Esau, we have all these rivaling brothers, and other rivalries as well, but these are the most famous ones. And then toward the end of the book, we have Jacob, who's coming to visit his son Joseph and bless his grandchildren, Ephraim and Manasseh. And we have this little story where, you know, Jacob is blind. He can't really see very well. So Joseph says, you know, Okay, here is Manasseh, who's standing in front of your right hand. So put your right hand on him and bless him. And here's Ephraim, the younger son. Bless him with your left hand. The right hand is the hand of prominence, so you would normally bless with your right hand. And Jacob, the kind of, you know, trickster that he is, crosses his arms and blesses them the opposite way and gives the greater blessing to the younger son, Ephraim. So many see this as a prophetic act. So Ephraim does actually attain the more prominent status. And that's fine. But the important thing for me of this story is nothing happens after this. There's no rivalry. There's no banishment. There's no anger. There's nothing. It's actually just a peaceful transaction. And it's the lack of rivalry that attracted me to this story. And Gerard doesn't ever really mention this story at all, although he does focus on siblings as rivals. So when we look at Genesis, we have to add that all those rivaling brothers in some way reconcile throughout the book too. But this is the pinnacle example, Ephraim and Manasseh. And kudos to Manasseh, who doesn't actually, you know, get envious of his brother who receives the greater blessing. So almost more kudos to him than to Ephraim.
Yeah, he doesn't take the Cain option in this.
No, absolutely right? Not.
What do we know about those two sons? Like, is there something in their background that leads them to take this blessing in a way that doesn't lead to rivalry, or just doesn't say anything about them other than that?
You know, people can ask perhaps if their parenting was better than perhaps. than earlier cases.
Yeah,
we don't know a whole lot. I mean, Joseph himself is a forgiving figure. But, you know, we don't really know anything about their upbringing or their character to this point. So it's really, really interesting. So how is this an antidote to violence in Jewish life is what I then talk about in this example. And the Jewish community uses this story, actually, on Shabbat Eve, the eve of the Sabbath, to bless their own children. This is a weekly ritual where, you know, we don't typically do it with arms crossed, but we'll embrace our children and say, may you be like Ephraim and Manasseh. Now, why do we do this? You know, why not Abraham, Moses, Isaac, or Jacob himself? Why don't we use the traditional patriarchs? And yet we don't. And I think I've often wondered why Ephraim and Manasseh, they're insignificant in a way. And now I have an answer by having studied Gerard's model and applying it to this text. I think it's because this is the first instance in the Hebrew Bible where we have two sons blessed instead of one. So where we have, there are a lot of theories about scarcity leading to rivalry. But where we have both sons blessed, and the blessing is of all importance in the Hebrew scriptures, the blessing is giving the child a future connected to God. So it's extremely important. If you don't have that, then you're living outside the community in a way. Your life doesn't have much of a future to live into. So both children get that bright future. And Jacob breaks tradition completely in this act by doing so. And instead of repeating his past, he's creating an entirely new future, not just for the two children, but for the Israelites in general. So this is, I see this of tremendous importance. So when we bless our children weekly, it's kind of like giving them this antidote to past violence. It's giving them a future of peace. It's giving them a way to move forward. And it's letting them know that they come from abundance, where everyone can be blessed. This is not just about the two Jewish grandchildren here. This is about the blessing for Ishmael and Isaac for all nations as well. So I see this as tremendous, a tremendous ritual that is something that I would call the antidote.
That's so profound and beautiful. And just, it's like, it's saying that you belong as opposed to being excluded. The blessing mm-hmm. is about belonging into something bigger than you, as opposed to being scapegoated or excluded. It's just,
that's right. It's
fantastic.
That's right. How many families have their scapegoats, right?
Oh my gosh.
A lot of families have their scapegoats.
Yeah. Family systems theory and mimetic theory go along with this. Yeah. Yeah. The one who takes on the, I don't know, problems of the family. And this is the great antidote, as you say, to doing that, is to reminding us and our children and everyone in the family that you're blessed. That's what mm-hmm. we're here to do. And it goes back to God's calling of Abraham, as you say, to be a blessing to all of the nations in Genesis 12. Like, that's our job, to be a blessing. It's fantastic.
Yeah, so that's right.
So let's get into the Jonah story and your chapter. You write that on Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, the people are commanded to listen to Jonah. And Jonah is 3 or 4 chapters long. It's a very short book.
It's four chapters, yeah.
Four chapters, yeah. So, but that the book of Jonah is picked on the Day of Atonement is a little strange, a little odd, because we don't think of it as really atonement. We think of like Leviticus or something like that. Imagine having to listen through like what, all 30 chapters of Leviticus in one sitting. Not so good. So I'm glad that they picked Jonah. But why Jonah? You write that Jonah offers two dichotomous atonement theories, theologies. One sacrificial and the other non-sacrificial. So can you walk us through Jonah and those two different atonement theologies?
Sure. I mean, Jonah is a great story. So I think really the only way to do this is to walk you through the story. And maybe some people haven't read the book recently, so it'll be helpful. But essentially, chapter one of the book of Jonah contains the first atonement theology, as I call it. So in chapter one, we have Jonah, who's called by God to go and prophesy Nineveh's doom to them. And Jonah just runs the other way. He says, no way am I doing that, God, right? And he winds up boarding a ship going to Tarshish, which is in the opposite direction of Nineveh. And the ship almost immediately enters a storm. There are a bunch of sailors on the ship as well, and they're terrified, and they each appeal to their own God in their own way, and they start throwing all the equipment overboard to try and lighten the load so that, you know, their ship won't topple over and they won't die. It's very interesting what the sailors do, actually. I'll just point out that one could call this a crisis situation. It would be if I were on that ship mm-hmm. flailing about, right? And a lot of people might think of this as, you know, in the Girardian sense, it would create a conflict or some kind of conflict on the ship. And so far, we don't see any hint of that. What happens next? Well, during this whole thing, Jonah's asleep in the hold of the ship, kind of downstairs. And a sailor goes and wakes Jonah up and says, hey, you know, get up, appeal to your God. We're in the middle of a storm. Help us out. So Jonah gets up. He comes upstairs. The storm is still going. It's getting stronger. And the sailors decide to cast lots to figure out who's responsible for this. Turns out to be Jonah. Again, what you would normally expect then is some kind of violence, or at least accusations or anger, but none of that happens. Instead, the narrative really slows down at this point, and the sailors start asking Jonah a series of questions. Who are you? Where are you from? What do you do? What God do you worship? You know, it's actually very interesting. And finally, what they ask him is, well, what do we need to do to stop the crisis? So their response is almost, it's a lesson in how to not fall into a mimetic crisis. You're looking at the person who could be blamed for all this, but you start to learn about him through your questions and you make him part of the solution. So the next part, Jonah says what they could do to stop the crisis is to throw him overboard. And the sailors go, we're not going to do that. You know, yeah. We're not going to be responsible for that. So they again try and steer the ship, try and get it under control, and they can't do it.
Jonah says really he does not want to go to Nineveh. I mean, he would rather die than go to Nineveh.
Yeah, and there's a history to that. You know, Nineveh was considered the mortal enemy of the Jewish people. They eventually come in and destroy Israel. And
Nineveh is the capital of the Assyrian Empire, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And powerful and known to be extremely immoral. So we have Jonah once again saying, throw me overboard, right? And the sailors really don't want to do it, but they agree maybe this is the only solution. Either Jonah gets sacrificed or they all die. So they agree to do it. But they make two pleas to God before they do it, right? First, they ask not to perish as the result of their deed. So they know what they're doing is wrong. They know it's a crime. And two, they declare Jonah's innocence, which is ironic because he is guilty. They declare Jonah's innocence, and at the same time, they're saying to God that they're only doing this because the Lord has done what he has pleased, meaning it's the will of God that they have to throw Jonah overboard because there's no other solution to this problem. So what do they do then? They acknowledge what they're about to do is a crime and they blame God for it. Mm-hmm. Say, oh, we have to do it because this is how you've arranged things. So what does this do in my assessment of the theology that's coming up here? This is starting to make God into a murderer, responsible for this death of this so-called innocent life, even in the sailor's words. Really interesting how they turn and create the situation and rationalize it.
Does God's voice come through? It, like, does God speak? Does God say, yeah, I want you to throw him over?
God never, ever in the text says it's his will that they throw Jonah overboard. It's Jonah's idea. And Jonah, through the very last sentence of the book, maintains the sacrificial mentality. He struggles and he just cannot get rid of it. So it's part of the fascination of this book is watching Jonah try and get away from the divine command and try and deal with his paradigm that he's known. It's the paradigm of sacrifice, of so-called good violence. And the sailors throw him overboard, and guess what? The storm abates. So it works. The murder works. And of course it does, right? It does work. It's just not a really good solution. So, and Gerard's structure works so beautifully here too, because once Jonah's thrown overboard, the sailors realize it worked. And then what do? They sacrifice to God. On board the ship, they create they didn't sacrifice before. It's never specified. But now they do. So if in Girardian terms, if we consider that Jonah is the originary event, the Jonah the scapegoat, and then the murder becomes ritualized as sacrifice to the Lord. So the first atonement theology of this chapter one of Jonah really is a sacrificial violin atonement theology, where God requires these sacrifices in order to be appeased. So chapter two is Jonah who gets in the belly of the great fish. Right. And we don't need to go into too much what happens there, but it is interesting if people go and read the text that Jonah does the same thing and essentially says, God, you know, look at what you've done to me. Mm. Nothing to do with Jonah's taking responsibility for any of this. Okay.
It's fascinating that this pattern of blaming God just runs throughout the scriptures. Like from Adam, we just had in the lectionary, we just had the story of Adam and Eve as we're beginning Lent. And Adam who blames Eve and also God for making Eve. It's just like this pattern just runs throughout Jonah and everywhere. So it's fascinating.
That's right.
To see those
That's
connections.
Right.
Yeah.
That's right. The when humans commit violence, the idea is that we have to rationalize it or blame it on someone else. No, it wasn't me. It wasn't my violence. God made me do it.
Might as well blame it on God. Yeah.
Why not? Right.
Yeah. Wow.
But it becomes so clear in this story, and it's infectious. Jonah's sacrificial mindset infects all of the sailors who initially, actually, I think, have the right idea. So Jonah's in the belly of the fish. He's blaming God for his predicament, in psalm, of course, you know, in beautiful poetry. Mm-hmm. And then the fish spits Jonah out, and God then comes. You do hear God's voice. It says, go to Nineveh. So it's like take two. Okay, go prophesy to Nineveh, their doom. So you could just imagine, Jonah goes this time. Mm-hmm. But he's probably covered in fish slime and, you know, he must reek. It's really a funny book. Okay, so he gets to Nineveh and he gives the shortest prophecy of the scriptures. And he says, in 40 days, Nineveh will be overturned. And then he get the image that he just runs out. But Nineveh's response is the second atonement theology that's represented. And it's fascinating. The people automatically, you know, instead of going to sacrifice and appease God, they put on sackcloth and they mourn and they fast at the king's behest, at the king of Nineveh's behest. The city that's known for complete immorality renounces violence completely. The king takes his place in sackcloth on, if we translate it properly, it means dirt. Many translations have ashes, which I think is very misleading, because it gives us the impression that there have been burnt sacrifices offered to try and appease the Lord. But it's really dirt. The king sits on dirt in mourning. And the people follow to the point where not only are animals not sacrificed, but the animals are also dressed in sackcloth and ordered to mourn and fast. So they're integrated into the community. Those who are the most vulnerable, who would be killed, are integrated and recognized and respected. So what's important here too is this verb overturned that Jonah uses in the Bible can mean either complete destruction or it can mean complete transformation. So Yom Kippur, you know, is this time when one's life is really kind of in crisis, if you will. It's on the balances. It says, are we going to be in the Book of Life again next year, or are we not going to be included? And this verb overturned in the Hebrew has the same sense of being caught in the balance, right? Which way is the balance going to fall? And they have to choose, like we each have to choose on the holiday. So the king orders then not just that all violence be renounced, but all violent plans and intentions be renounced. This is almost, you know, this is extraordinary. There's an interchange called, and you have this image in the Hebrew of these paired hands that are lined up in openness and in community of all working together. So there's no violence here. There's no scapegoating. There's no substitution of any kind. It's complete non-violence. violence. And what they represent here is the complete return from sin. And what happens next, right? God doesn't destroy them. And that's what I see as the second atonement theology. When humans renounce the violence and come up with a created solution to their crisis, then God can respond in kind. What we do can actually reflect the God that we are in relationship with. So that's the second atonement theology, that the human way of nonviolence allows God in many ways to be a nonviolent deity. So these are the two, and both atonement theologies are actually effective, and they're both upheld in different parts of the scripture, but it's really up to us to choose which one we're going to follow. And I think there's enough in the text, especially with the sailors, that tells us that there's really not the appropriate choice to follow if we can only read the text carefully enough.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Like when we hear the Ninevites and the Assyrians, we might think of terrorists. We might think of how radical is it for us to imagine terrorists being converted in this way? I mean, that's what the ancient Jewish writer is doing, right? He or she is envisioning the greatest enemies that they have at the moment having this conversion experience.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely right. Absolutely right. We might sit there looking over Nineveh from our hilltop, struggling like Jonah is.
Yeah.
Get it out of that mentality that, oh, they were so bad that, come on, God, you need to punish them. Mm. Where's justice? Right. And this is a book I also use to teach about Jewish mercy and the merciful God of Judaism. Because I think there's a really profound misconception in other religious traditions, mostly Christianity, that sees the Old Testament as having the God of wrath and punishment, and the New Testament as having the God of love and peace. And I use this book of Jonah to say, look at this profound act of mercy, you know, and the scriptures are interesting that you could argue that, you know, God is not necessarily going to forgive because of what the Ninevites do. God is free to do whatever he chooses, to do whatever he chooses, whether or not one repents. Mm. But I think it's the mimetic effect, actually, the mimetic relationship, perhaps, between humans and God that has nonviolence expand. The more it's practiced, the more it expands from our human actions and conceptions to our divine actions and conceptions.
Can you talk more about the relationship between mercy and justice?
Oh, you're killing me.
we can edit this out and go to something else because that's just too big
that
to ask you right now.
It is big, and there's an awful lot of writings on justice and mercy. And I think, you know, Judaism absolutely focuses on both. And I think Jonah is perhaps a perfect book to use, where you have to understand in many ways, I think, the context that you're dealing with when you are trying to understand things like justice and mercy. And I'm a strong promoter of the humanities, because I think the humanities really teach about understanding context in a very social justice, you know, point of view. We look at an individual that may have committed a bad act, or we can look at Nineveh and we could say, well, do we take that act at face value and implement justice? Or do we look at the context of that act and attempt a merciful position? And I don't think they're mutually exclusive. I think we need justice, but we also need to do it with mercy. And that changes how the justice takes effect. Rehabilitation will come through a context of mercy. Further punishment and humiliation and anger and violence will come from strict justice. So I think Judaism really handles these imbalance really well in, you know, you can see it in the Hebrew scriptures, but also in writings, you know, going through the centuries.
Yeah, I love it. In Ravencast, Vanessa Avery, part two, let's talk more about justice and mercy, because this is such an important discussion to have, especially today in the cultural climate that we're in, justice and mercy.
Yeah, that's true.
But when we talk about atonement, there's no way that we can't talk about the book of Leviticus, right? Leviticus is often the book when people try to read all the way through the Bible where they stop, get stuck. What do you make of Leviticus? This is probably another question that could be its own episode. I think a lot of you were talking about how there's a Christian strand that says, oh, the Old Testament is just incredibly violent and stuff, and oftentimes gets Leviticus in there on that. And I think that there's so much more going on in Leviticus, and I'm wondering what you make of it.
Yeah, Leviticus is definitely one of the more difficult books to approach. Mm-hmm. You know, I am... I'm not the greatest fan. I mean, it's not entertaining really to me personally. Mm-hmm. And it's really foreign to us. You know, the vocabulary is foreign. The rituals are really foreign. It's really just not a text that people, I think, today can identify with. But it's really important. And it's important, I think, in a few ways. So religiously, it's important to a Jewish person because Leviticus expresses how one can be loyal to God. It's how to praise God properly. And it lays that out in incredible detail. So the buzzword for Leviticus is holy and holiness. You know, the Lord God is holy, and so we must be holy. And how do we really attain that holiness? You know, holiness means set apart. And how one is set apart is by following the design that God has planted in this book. The Jews are the only ones called to follow all of these different rituals. So I think when people hear Leviticus, they think primarily of the sacrifices. But it's really most of the foundational Jewish laws that are contained in there, the rituals. So we have the laws of kashrut, the kosher dietary laws. We have laws regarding the calendar and the holy days, including Yom Kippur. We have the Decalogue, or the Ten Commandments. We have how to keep the sanctuary and how to keep the land. So really foundational Jewish ideas. So we have to, you know, keep the book. Mm-hmm. And I think most important is how we relate to the book. You know, can we find some ways in to think about the book that give us a good relationship to it? And I think, you know, please stop me if I'm going on too long. I'll try and sum this up really quickly. But I think there are two things about Leviticus that people kind of latch onto. One is why all the rituals. People might ask that about Judaism too. You know, why? Why do we have to do all these things? Well, if we think about, you know, going all the way back then, all the rituals, including the sacrifices, were ways for people to be connected to God. But I think that the most important bottom line about all these rituals is that it's about leading an intentional life. Right. I mean, I think about all these self-help books out there, like the Seven Habits of Highly Effective People, you know, all this. There are so many self-help books on changing habits and cultivating, you know, ways of being, you know, that you feel will improve your life and give you success and give you money and all these things. So there's something about intention. All these books exist because as human beings, it's really, really, really hard for us to be intentional about everything we do. So all of these rituals, as I see them, are really about leading an intentional life that is not just of our own creation, but that shows and demonstrates that we're choosing God, right? So God has given two paths, the path of life and the path of death. The path of life includes following this design and being intentional and always choosing it. And if we do, the idea is that we will have blessing. And if we don't feel that way, at least we'll be connected in relation to our deity for support when we're not feeling blessed. It gives us a structure through which to get through those hard times when we're not feeling that way. So that's my first idea about Leviticus, is really thinking about ritual. Doesn't matter what the rituals are. I'm going to talk about the violence and stuff, but it doesn't matter what they are. It's about the intentionality and the choosing. So if I'm kosher, right, Leviticus tells me to eat this way. It tells me how to prepare my food this way, down to what plate I put the food on and what fork I choose to eat the food. So every time I choose, I'm actually choosing God. I'm connected in that moment of choice. Okay. So I see this as the purpose of all rituals. The second question is maybe the stuff about blood sacrifice, right? The gory stuff, the violence. Well, obviously this isn't done anymore, except there's an interesting way to look at it. Again, if we're going to develop a relationship to Leviticus, maybe it is done and we just don't realize it. So maybe ancient blood sacrifice. First of all, you have to understand that the pagans and the ancient Israelites had practices they were really attached to. They weren't just going to give them all up. So it was important to keep practices, although Judaism redefined what those practices meant, right? So initially, if the pagan blood sacrifices were to expel demons and create, you know, protection from the god they wanted, then Judaism redefined it by saying this is about sin, and sin causes the presence of the Lord to depart, and the sacrifice will bring God's presence back into the sanctuary. All right, so Judaism redefined these. So Leviticus is really important historically. I just want to make that point. But let me get back to the more entertaining point, if you will, which is, okay, so you have an animal that's chosen, sacrificed, the blood is given to God on the altar. Perhaps it's sprinkled, perhaps it's splashed, you know, various things are done with the blood. And the flesh of the animal is typically then eaten. Even a cereal offering would be eaten afterwards. So this was food. And if we look at what we do today, at least in the laws of kashrut, right, the kosher laws, well, we don't slaughter and drain the blood of the animal in our homes. So it's done, you know, without our seeing it for the most part. But in the laws of kashrut, the animal is slaughtered in a very particular way. It's also blessed, as it was in the ancient temple. The blood is drained. We don't eat the blood because that's the life of the animal, and the life only goes to God. And then the flesh of the meat is actually brined in salt water so that it pulls out any blood that might have not drained. And then again, we go to the kosher butcher and buy the meat. And when we cook the meat, we cook it to well done to ensure that there is no blood left. All the life is dedicated to God still in these dietary laws. and then we eat. Mm-hmm. Isn't that the same, just perhaps less dramatic, because the slaughtering and the bloodletting happens elsewhere and not on our dining table?
Yeah, I think that one of the things that I appreciate about what you're saying is that we put all of our animals off in the distance so that we don't have to see how we're treating them, right? Like, so these are our scapegoats. I mean, forget the whole conversation about whether we should all be vegetarians or not.
Yes.
But the animals that we sacrifice today are off in the distance in places where we don't see how they're being treated. And oftentimes they're not treated very well. My wife saw a news report when she was 12 years old on how cows are treated. Mm-hmm. And she was like, I'm not eating steak anymore. She hasn't eaten steak or beef ever since. So I think that as you say, the intention of how Leviticus moves us through these rituals is something crucially important. And we could be much more intentional about how we treat animals today. So yeah, I appreciate that point very much. The other thing that I've heard about Leviticus is that Christians often use it to say, God has always been angry at us, and we've always had to propitiate the anger of God, and this is what Leviticus is doing. And I'm just not sure how much of that is in Leviticus. I think Leviticus is much more of a Thanksgiving offering. I've heard that there's not a whole lot of anger in God within the book of Leviticus. Is that true, or what do you
think? There are some propitiatory offerings. I would say Leviticus's sacrifices, there are many different kinds of sacrifice, first of all, so they're not all to propitiate an angry God, but there are a few in there, and I would say they're remnants of the old atonement theology, you know, which we went through in Jonah. It's the old theology that what can you do? You know, some of those remnants did creep in. But it's important to see the developments because it's not the only atonement theology in there.
So even in Leviticus, you have these two atonement theologies that are working their way through the book.
Yeah, you do have, I would say, the atonement theology that came next, which was, I think I mentioned it briefly earlier, where you no longer have the to appease the angry God or propitiation, but you have now the sacrifice as the means to bring God's presence into the sanctuary. So it's about a covenantal relationship. It's building a relationship. And that's very different from, you know, doing something to appease anger. And Leviticus has that atonement theology as well. It's not one-dimensional in terms of sacrifice by any means.
That's fascinating. So we have 1 minute left, and I want to give you like one last question that should be its own episode. So going back to Jonah and the Ninevites, they were both in this cultural crisis. Jonah's boat is sinking, and many of us feel that the American boat is sinking. What are some lessons, I guess, from Jonah about how to handle the modern cultural crisis that we're going through right now?
Can you hear me okay? Just checking.
Yes.
Okay. A pop-up came up. So what can we do now to address the American cultural crisis? Lessons from Jonah. Uh-huh. That's a great question. I think there are a few things we could learn from Jonah. If we just look at the actions in both sets of the book, right? So the sailors, they certainly had the right intentions. So what did they do? They worked communally to save their ship. They asked questions of the one they could have accused and blamed, being Jonah. And this slowed the narrative down. So if we just take those things, I mean, if we could just manage that much, right, working communally to save our sinking ship. Mm-hmm. And I think we're going to be okay, but I understand there's a lot going on here. And then engaging the other through asking questions and trying to understand. In the midst of a crisis, you could still attempt to understand the other. So how does one dialogue? And coming at it from a curiosity point of view. And don't give up. So they eventually give up thinking there's no other option and they throw him overboard. But what could have happened was that had they kept talking, perhaps Jonah would have realized what he really needed to do was repent. Mm. Had Jonah repented, the storm might have ceased. We don't, that's the alternative ending to Jonah we don't have. Mm. So perhaps through dialogue, we could actually achieve some amazing results.
I love it. Fantastic.
I think our time is probably up. I could go on.
Well, we'll have to do this again. Before we do it again, what books or other projects do you have coming up?
I have a book coming out from Michigan State University Press called The End of Violence. And it covers several different Hebrew scriptures and their connected Jewish rituals and how they're antidotes to violence. And it uses a Girardian framework to talk about them. I also have my consulting business, which we talked about, and I offer diversity series, short seminars, a series, whatever your business needs, I tailor it to you. I also have other seminars called Reality, looking at different perspectives from philosophy and spiritual traditions on reality, ethics, the virtues that we all need today to address our current climate. I also have a Zen office series where we focus on principles and practices from the Zen tradition in your workplace. So these are my two projects, my consulting business and my book.
Fantastic. We've got some comments. Great conversation from Russ Hewitt. Jed Gore, someone you know, says, great conversation. Nicely done. Dave says, thanks for this. Looking forward to reading the Watchmen article. Yes, Dave, I highly recommend it. I can send it to you. So it's fantastic. So if people want to contact you for organizational consulting, whether in a business place or a place of worship, how can they get a hold of you?
My website is transcendenceeducation.com. And I have an email address, transcendenceeducation@gmail.com. And my phone number is on my website as well. So you can find it there.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Vanessa, for being with us here today. And thanks, everyone, for joining us. You can stay up to date on the Ravencast by joining the Ravencast Facebook group. You can also like the Raven Foundation Facebook page. If you are watching on YouTube, feel free to give us a like and share it with anybody that you think might be interested. If you're listening on iTunes or Stitcher, please subscribe, leave us a comment, give us a rating. It really helps us get the word out. Also, go on over to the Raven Review at ravenfoundation.org and subscribe to the website. And that'll make sure that you keep up to date on our articles and other interviews like this. Once again, next Thursday at 12 o'clock Central, we'll be live with Sue Wright, the president of Theology and Peace. We're going to be talking about the upcoming conference. I think it's in late May. And it's titled Embracing We-Centricity, Practices That Nurture the Common Good. So I hope you can join us then. Until next time, grace and peace be with you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you, everyone.